Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. Before we launch into our conversation with Dr. Andres Alonso, CEO of our Baltimore City Public School System, I want to tell you that support for WEAA's traffic is provided by Theragesic, Theragesic pain-relieving cream for arthritis, back pain, and muscle soreness.
Crash in Harford County, still giving you some problems on Bel Air Road with the update brought to you by Caltrade. The problem, the road shut down. Sunshine Avenue to Mountain Road. Crash with the pole and wires down in between there near the county line. Try Harford Road or the Pulaski Highway instead. 95 northbound delays, 895 merge to White Marsh Boulevard with northbound 895 sluggish as you approach the 95 merge. Inner loop delays, the usual spots, top and west sides. Outer loop running heavy with a little bit of slowing from Lockraven Boulevard to the Harrisburg Expressway. County accidents, York at Moncton for an overturned vehicle, a crash. Philadelphia Road eastbound at Industrial Park Road. Baltimore City crashes, Preston at St. Paul, Old York at Greenmount, Erdman at Mapleton. And expect increased pedestrian traffic in the city due to the ballgame tonight at Camden Yards. Two at 665 crash in Anne Arundel County. Caltrate, get a little TLC every day. Tender, loving Caltrate. Caltrate has essential daily calcium, plus advanced levels of vitamin D to help you absorb that TLC. I'm Joanna Campbell with Baltimore Area Traffic.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. This hour, we are joined for the entire hour by Dr. Andres Alonso, CEO of the Baltimore City Public School System, on this week that our children have off in the city schools for spring break. Teachers, students, parents, we encourage you to join us here at 410-319-8888. All those teachers who called today and said, we want to be part of this conversation, join us now, 410-319-8888, as we talk with Dr. Andres Alonso, or whoever you are, if you care about education and our children, write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. So you're here doing spring break instead of taking a vacation. No vacations.
I've always said 24/7, 365, right?
You have always said that.
Yeah.
You have said that.
It annoys some people who work for me, because if I'm on 24/7, 365, they probably are too.
So tell me the state of the state legislature at the moment in terms of school funding. You made comments at a forum on school truancy that was held at UB not long ago, just a few days ago, actually. When asked about the budget, you went into this conversation about teachers not getting a raise if it doesn't go through, and the teachers now in unions on your side being in Annapolis, but that they will not get the – I think the quote was, because they won't get – now here's what you say, the quote was – I now have the teachers' union working for me in Annapolis to reverse the cuts because they won't get a dime in salary from me for the next 3 years if they go through.
I said extra.
Extra. So let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, the reality is that, first of all, let me acknowledge how difficult the situation is for our legislators in Annapolis, because they see a structural deficit that if the economy doesn't improve, is in the offing for the next few years. And what developed, I guess, a couple of weeks ago now, was a proposal coming out of a Senate committee that changed what the House had submitted, and which was already a change on what the governor had submitted, in ways that deeply impacted the public schools. We were looking at cuts of almost $12 million on top of what the governor had proposed, and there were other programs that were also falling off, meaning that in total we were looking at cuts of roughly $18 million for this year, in a situation where I had already submitted a budget that included tens of millions of dollars in cuts, including the reduction of 179 positions in North Avenue, meaning that over 2 years, I'd have had to cut the central office by 489 positions in order to protect the budgets for the schools. And in the budget that we approved, we did not include a cost of living increase for anyone, because we were not getting an increase in terms of general funds in our budgets. If we were faced with a situation of cutting another $10 million in general funds, then that's very problematic. And as we projected forward and we saw that the proposal was essentially taking away any increase over the next 2 years, and at a time when we know that every single year the cost of doing business in the city because of steps for teachers and administrators, et cetera, goes up, then it becomes very difficult to give cost of living increases without in some way impacting schools and impacting jobs. So the rhetoric in that meeting was very much about making very dramatic what is at stake in this conversation, which is that we should use every ounce of political juice we have in order to protect the budgets for the public schools, not because it saves jobs, but because we have so much ground to cover in terms of becoming the school system that we're going to be. And I have always said that it's not about money, that it's about people and how they do their job. But if we cannot be competitive with other jurisdictions who are able to give their school systems more dollars in order to attract teachers and in order to attract administrators, then it makes the job very, very hard.
Now, the quote I read with Melody Simmons, who reports often for the station and for us and writes for Maryland Commons and the Baltimore Brewers, who was at the UB meeting, and that's where we got these quotes and who gave them to us. And she also told us when she came back with this report that that you are looking into a new salary structure for teachers, that you mentioned something about those with master's degree in teaching would not necessarily get the extra steps and extra money.
I have made no such statements. It was and I would need to talk to Melanie in order to understand how she interpreted my comments.
Okay.
There were several panelists in the conversation was the question of whether master's degrees add to the effectiveness of teachers.
Right.
And there
right.
was another panelist who...
Kate Walsh, I think.
Yes,
right?
Who made the statement that the research is not there showing that there is a relationship between master's degrees and increases in student outcomes, and also made the statement that districts might perhaps be looking into ways of putting some of the dollars that are spent in paying teachers to get graduate degrees into changes into pay structures for teachers. I did not make those statements, and not only did I not make those statements, it's pretty ridiculous in the present situation where we have to be very sensitive to the teachers' union and the other unions around questions of the contract, because we have asked them to work with us for a year to look at the economic situation in terms of what happens with the district to appear to be imposing anything. So if that's the way, if it was reported that I had made this statement, I will tell you that it is categorically false. And reporters need to be a little bit more careful about how they report what people state, because it was a conversation, abstract conversation with another panelist making certain statements. I certainly did not agree with the statement. As a matter of fact, part of what I said was that part of the reason why Baltimore City has certain working condition elements in the contract that are different than other jurisdictions is because we have never been able to pay our teachers as well as others. So since we cannot have not been able to pay them as well as other jurisdictions, then we need to compromise in other ways. It's part of doing business. If you cannot give somebody something, you give it to them in other ways.
This is I don't want to spend time on kind of large kind of philosophical questions here. Uh-huh. But I may ask this question. I mean, the way you look at this and look at your role as CEO and working with the teachers in the school system, your counterpart in Washington.
My friend Michelle.
Your friend Michelle Rhee in Washington has really taken on the teachers union, and they've become really enemies in that school district. You seem to be taking a different tack, though. I mean, you have drawn some lines of your own from the very beginning.
Well, what's interesting is that at the beginning, and I remember telling you in this show that I was not. That none of this was personal or it was about being anti-union. When I took a stance around collaborative planning, I made sure that everybody understood that it was about the issue. I felt that that collaborative planning is an essential in terms of a school or a district's ability to improve outcomes for kids if it's done right. So given that that was the case, it was my stance. And because we had no money, I made it a necessity without being able to give teachers more money for it. But my job is not to give people money. It is to create the conditions for our schools to get better. So that was the debate at the time. Once that went away, then the question became, how do I work with teachers and how do I work with the unions in order to make progress? And I think there are many ways of skinning the cat quite often, and part of my job is to figure out how to skin it right in a particular situation. So this is no guarantee that I'm going to get along with the teachers union forever. But I will tell you that sometimes the conversation about school improvement takes lines that are sometimes they're exaggerated, sometimes they're not. I can't comment on Michelle's situation because she has her own set of facts. She's dealing with different people. She's not dealing with the people that I'm dealing with. She has a different history in the district. I feel that we have made tremendous progress in the first year. We're making tremendous progress in the second year. And I also feel that I can do everything that I need to do to make the system move forward without getting into oppositional conversations with anybody, really. And quite often, the debates are made about polarization, as in, you know, 2 months ago, it was about me fighting with the governor.
Right.
Well, I wasn't fighting with the governor. I was taking a stance based upon a particular moment in time, taking a position that I needed to take for the benefit of the children of the city. And once that moment passed, then I give the governor all the credit that he's due because he's a supporter of the schools and the city and my work, and I have great respect for him. So things get dramatized, and I feel that they shouldn't get dramatized, that we should focus as much as possible on the work, the kids. There are things that it's in their business of unions to protect their members. And it is in the business of superintendent to push the envelope so that work is not about the adults, it's about the kids. And giving those two different definitions of people's roles, it is inevitable that there will be moments that are about opposition and confrontation, and there will also be other moments when people, you know, come to the table and say, well, you know, how do we work together to make this happen? Ultimately, there has to be collaboration because the teachers are not the unions. The teachers are my teachers, and they are the union's teachers when it comes to salaries, benefits, and due process. But the rest of the time, they're mine. And it is in my interest to have them happy, learning, committed to the work, and feeling that the system works for them, not that they are, you know, in a mine shaft somewhere.
Dr. Andres Alonso is in the studio. Number is 410-319-8888. Number of conversations in the last couple of days with public school teachers. We want you to join us now at 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on the airwaves here as we talk with Andres Alonso, CEO of our city school system, teachers and students and parents and those concerned about the future of education of our children. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. or get to the phones at 410-319-8888, and we'll get to those calls have conversations here with our CEO. Some of the teachers that I've been talking to have been talking to me about the problem that they say that many people, even those who support you, don't get, and that maybe you don't get, they're saying to me, is that there is violence in our schools that's being ignored, that their schools are, in some places, just not in control, but nobody seems to be paying attention. Now,
this has been a two-year conversation.
Yes.
So I'm not sure that that anyone can say that people are ignoring certain things. When we close schools, for example,
as you did with Walbrook and many others, yeah. LaMelle is closing.
Yes. I mean, I don't know how much more active a response can be to teachers saying this is not an environment that is conducive to learning than to close a school. Ironically, what then comes back is, you know, you shouldn't be closing the schools. You should be working with the school to support the school.
That happened the last time we spoke.
Yeah, yes. And which is ironic. I mean, quite frankly, if you tell me that there's a problem, I'm going to deal with it in the quickest possible way, in ways that are going to make it possible for adults and children to function as they move forward. So there is that. Secondly, there is constantly a complaint of things not being done in a certain way. What is remarkable, though, is that every single time there is an investigation or every single time there is a deep dive into issues, there has been a response. It's quite often not a response that people are happy with, because in this district, this is an environment that tends to be about extremes. So that quite often you have on one side folks who are saying we must hang the kids. That's the appropriate response. And on the other side, folks who are saying, no, we must make sure that those poor children never suffer and don't miss a single moment of school. That's the range that I constantly get in the emails. And the attempt to somehow walk a line that differentiates and gives people certain flexibility while at the same time ensure that in certain cases there is an immediate and quite certain response. You know, we don't always do it right, but I think we're doing it better than in the past. The other issue is that when we look at we've done so much around giving schools certain tools, you know, the metal detectors, the wands, the Success Academy in terms of the alternative schools. We've pulled so many kids and given them the alternative school option. The more we do, the more there's a demand, I think, in terms of do more. And I think that part of what we all need to own is the fact that if we're going to be a successful school system, we need to create environments where school own the responsibility of working with all the kids and create environments where the kids are being channeled into positive things. The demand for a kind of politics of exclusion has to hit a wall in the conversation, because it essentially means that we're failing as a school system, as a community. All the indicators, this is the interesting thing as well. Every single indicator that we look at shows progress and success. What you probably read about today in the Sun,
80% of meaning the high school seniors have met.
80% of high school seniors have now met the criteria for graduation that the state imposed. When at the beginning of the year,
city school students,
the beginning of the year or last year, the predictions were so dire in terms of where we were, what needed to happen, shows an extraordinary focusing on the needs of kids and schools working effectively to meet those needs. And that fact is fundamentally at odds with a picture that is often presented of schools where positive things are not happening. So it's striking to me that there are so many indicators of success, and yet there is such a strong assertion that things remain the same or have gone backwards. The other piece, and I said this in that conference where your friend Melanie was, there's a golden age mentality in this district about how much better things used to be. You know what the graduation rate was in 1996 in this district? It was in the low 40s, my friend. So
And that was low. That was 40% of those who remained.
Correct.
After
correct.
The apples, 60% who left after the ninth grade.
Correct. Apples right. to apples.
Right.
So, you know, I'm looking at these numbers and I'm looking at the jumps that have taken place, and not under me, because I try very hard to continually assert that it's work that has been going on for a long time, and that the work is being done in the schools. I mean, if you're a district where 40% of the kids are graduating, and then 13 years later, 63% of the kids are graduating, we're still failing, but we're doing a much better job than we used to.
I want to come back to testing and success in graduates, but let me open the phones. People are calling in at 410-319-8888. As we talk with Dr. Andres Alonso, CEO of our Baltimore City Public Schools, 410-319-8888, and William in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, Dr. Alonso, my question surrounds the, you know, you just made a statement about, you know, new processes, new thoughts, and incorporating them for the betterment of the kids. And your engagement policy, which I think is wonderful, but my, I guess my hesitation is how much training was given to your principals and staff at these schools to really truly understand the meaning of outreach and engaging the community with parents and the business and business partners and other organizations that could partner with the schools, and what has been put in place to monitor to see whether or not there has been is going to be a successful endeavor, and that the principals are actually putting forth the effort to be more inclusive and with their partners.
Well, thank you for the phone call, first of all, and I think that the question is a very important question to me, because it's very much about the willingness of the school system to be truly open in partnership with the community, not as in, you know, we're in the community and our job is to make the community work. No, it's we're in the community, and together we need to make the schools and the community work. We put in professional development sessions for principals, for school improvement folks, for people in PTAs. We ask them to be together in the professional development sessions. We move very, very fast. As
yes,
in, remember that, and part of it is the contingency of budget approvals and board approvals. So we are fully cognizant of the fact that this is a work in progress. But it's a work in progress that takes us in the right direction. And if you follow the work that I've done here and the work that I did in New York before I came here, you can see that I'm willing to take risks if I think that the direction is right. So I'm not expecting perfection. I'm expecting that every single school do certain things, as in there has to be a public engagement process. A family council has to be in place, and there's a verification process where every single principal now needs to come back to us with the membership, the dates when the meeting is taking place, the budgets that are going to be submitted to me in the second week of May are going to require the signature of the school improvement leader, as in not, you know, we agree to this because it's still the principal's responsibility, but it is about, you know, a sign that there has been an engagement. And then we will keep looking at the process to make sure that it's been legitimate, as we did last year.
Okay.
We see the following, for example. When I came into the district, in my first meeting with community people on the first day I was appointed, I was asked to estimate how many schools have functioning PTAs, PTOs. And when I just threw the word, you know, 50%, everybody around the room kind of laughed and say, no, 10%. I can tell you that today, because of the work of people like Michael Carter and Michael Sarbanes, they have, you know, the overwhelming number of schools have functioning bodies. They're not where we need them to be. But there's been an attempt to engage parents. And in this process, we have enough safety valves in place around verification, about seeing the names of people on spreadsheets, about going back to make sure that the conversations have taken place, that, you know, they're not going to be fully functioning charter boards on month number one, but we want that to grow as we move as a system.
Well, did you have another comment? I'll charge you and break in before we go back to the phones at 410-319-8888.
The process, by the way, is still beginning. So part of what we hope is that to the extent that there are issues, then people like you come back to the table and let us know, you know, this is a place where you need to intervene.
William, thank you so much. Unless you had another comment, did you? Is William gone? Okay, all right. So we've got these other calls coming in here a second. Let me go back to the testings. I have questions about the community and schools I want to kind of bring up, and questions of teacher quality I want to make sure we get to, and we will get to. But that I had Dr. Grasmick on here just the other week, and I really challenged some of the notion of what these tests are really showing us. That when we say that 80% of our high school seniors are graduating, but are passing these tests, so I'm saying, well, what are the tests really showing? What are we learning from these tests? I mean, if the tests have been so changed so much, they're now, instead of being you have to pass all the tests, then we couldn't get that done because people couldn't pass them, it became averaging them out, then we stopped averaging them out, and if you can't pass it, well, we'll give you a project to do so you can graduate. So the question remains, and then on top of that, the statistics of what happens in our community colleges, where 61% of Baltimore City high school graduates going to our community colleges have to go into remedial math or English, or especially English. But this, so I'm not sure what these tests are really telling us. We're all gloating about them, but they're not saying much to me in terms of the reality of what's happening to these children.
We're not gloating about them. We are taking pride in having reached a goal. As in,
I wasn't saying you were gloating, Andres. I'm just wondering. What I'm saying is that we keep talking about these tests as some kind of benchmark, but I'm not sure what they're really telling us.
Part of the reason why, when people were telling me, you know, you can't support the test because so many of your kids won't graduate, and you remember that part of the debate, I hope.
Yes.
I said, what do you mean we cannot support the test because we're going to fail or because the kids are going to fail? They're basic proficiency tests. So if we cannot even endorse the ability of our kids in our schools to get our kids to basic proficiency tests, then we are in much deeper trouble than anybody wants to admit. So we took on a challenge, looking at the evidence at the time in terms of what our kids had done, because we felt, you know what, we need to do this. The Secretary of Education is now talking about changes in standards that are going to move these types of tests to much higher rigor. And this is the start of the conversation for me in the city in terms of where we need to bring our kids. The reality is the following. We started with a huge challenge in terms of kids who had been in the system for 10 years already, and they couldn't pass the test. And then a year later, a year and a half later, we've gotten to the point where the majority of the kids have passed the test. There is a group of kids who have passed the combined score, and there's another group of kids for whom there has been an extraordinary amount of work done around projects. By the way, the work that has been done about the projects, I think, is good for the school system in terms of beginning to reorient teaching and learning, especially in the high schools, around a project-based approach, which is what you and I did when we got to college, and it's what most of us do in real life. In real life, you're not given knowledge to communicate in pencil and paper tests. You are doing projects that demonstrate your mastery of a particular subject. So I'm very much in support of the direction of giving students the opportunity to demonstrate mastery through projects.
Well, I'm going to follow up on this question. We're going to take a short break and come back. Let me just take a short break and come back. And when we come back, 410-319-8888, Evan a parent calling in. And Russ, the first three callers up, we'll come to your calls when we come back. 410-319-8888. Stay with us as we talk with Dr. Andres Alonzo, CEO of our Baltimore City Public Schools.
One other thing that I was going to tell you is Linda Eberhardt is introducing the Aquaplacer in 10th grade.
She's introducing what?
Linda Eberhardt.
Yeah.
As a way of getting us to...
She's introducing what she said when she was introducing.
The Aquaplacer, which is the...
I'm Mark Steiner. Our guest this hour is Dr. Andres Alonzo, CEO of the Baltimore City Schools. As I promised, we're going to head right to the phones. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We have an email or two here as well that I will read, but let's first go to the phone. And the person waiting the longest is Evan in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Hey, Mark.
Hey.
Great show.
You're Evan.
Dr. Alonzo.
Is this Mark's Evan?
It's Evan's Evan, I think. I don't think
you did. How you doing, Evan?
All right, how you doing?
By the way, when am I going to make you a principal, man? The whole deal is I've been saying, you know, new leaders. When are you going to step up to the challenge, man?
We'll have to talk about that another time.
Transformation school, you know, come on, man.
Well, my question was about discipline.
Yeah.
As you know, there are a lot of discipline issues, and it seems that it varies from school to school, but we have some serious issues around discipline, and I was wondering if maybe you could speak a little bit about that, because it's directly related to testing, and as a teacher, I find it's very difficult to deliver instruction for any tests or any type of assessments when we have such serious problems in the hallways. We have a lot of kids coming and going. Not quite sure what the rules are. I mean, I know what the rules are, but they seem to vary administrator to administrator, and it's a real problem. It's a real hostile work environment for kids and teachers in some situations, and really need to do something about that. So if you could speak on that, that'd be great, sir.
And thank you. And I think that you have, you know, in the question, you have captured the dilemma as I see it. First of all, there's tremendous variability, as in... what is reported as an issue in some schools is not an issue in others. And part of the dilemma for me is how to use the variability in order to get to standards where, you know, it's where that environment that you're describing is not, it's in as few schools or in no schools whatsoever as we move forward. Secondly, I think that leadership matters tremendously. And what is significant is that it used to be that a lot of the conversation was about a particular set of schools. But, you know, now you have some schools that have made tremendous leaps in terms of the climate and other schools that were not part of the conversation that sometimes enter the conversation, which suggests that it's not necessarily about the kids and who gets in. It's about something else. Thirdly, and your school, and we won't mention your school, but I know who you are and what school you come from, is it's interesting in that, you know, there has been an ongoing series of concerns raised to me about, you know, climate or quality of life issues in the school, and yet the evidence appeared to be very clear that there has been tremendous work done around outcomes and student work in the school. So there's a disconnect in the conversation sometimes. I will tell you the following. The rules are clear, I think, for everyone, and how it gets administered, it's what creates the disconnect in the conversation. I feel strongly that when children are pushing the envelope in terms of behavior, the school should have a set of interventions to try to keep the kids in school as much as possible, because if our reflex is to push them out, then we're not helping them or ourselves. They come back with the same behaviors. There are going to be a set of instances where it's not about being in the hallway. It's about completely challenging the structure of a school. And then the response should be far stronger. And if done consistently, I think it's going to get at the way most kids act. When the behavior, however, is behavior that includes violence, then there should be no flexibility, and the response should be quite clear in terms of what's acceptable and not acceptable in a school.
I don't want to spend the rest of the hour on this. We have many more callers, and I have some questions I do have to get to here. But, Evan, are you still on the line? Still there?
I'm still there.
Okay. Yeah. So just a follow-up with what you were saying in response to Andres Alonso, and then we can let him respond again and move on.
Well, I totally agree. It's how we've had this discussion a number of times this year, and we've talked in person, and I feel like there is a disconnect between what Dr. Alonso and North Avenue is saying to these administrators and what they're actually doing, because he's always said be creative, and here's the parameters, but you can do whatever you do within those parameters, and then if you go outside the boundaries, we'll pull you back in. But I just feel like a lot of people in leadership are scared to actually take leadership and, you know, be creative about their situation, because each school is different, populations are different, dealing with different types of issues.
And to be fair in the discussion, we've had enormous turnover in leadership in the last 2.5 years. I mean, I made 54 replacements in my first year in the job. And that means that, you know, there's growth in the job.
Principles, you're talking about.
There's growth in the job for many people. There is also, as you know, as you acknowledge, tremendous variability. So in some places it's been, you know, you could remarkable growth in terms of certain indicators of what you're describing. In other places, there has been a need to continually go back to the drawing table. I've had to send teams from North Avenue to 3 or 4 high schools this year because I felt that there was a need for support on the part of the principal. But that's an admission of failure on the part of the school, in that you know, if the students at some level don't feel that the adults are exerting authority, then it's deeply problematic for me. And any administrator who sees me send a team of people to a school, they should take that as an early sign that things are not going to be the same.
Right.
Because it means that, you know, in most schools, that's not necessary. A school community comes together to exert authority to do what needs to be done. I will also say something else, which is that the district has been driven by, in the past, I think, by indicators that are about compliance. And as in, you know, we don't want to be persistently dangerous, or we don't want to be this. And I am so outside of that frame that I find it difficult to understand that, you know, what I want is a common sense response. And I want people to do really creative. For example, in Success Academy, we only instruct for half the day. The other half of the day, we have the kids, you know, doing a host of other things.
The academy, it's at North Avenue.
Yeah. Right. As in, it's a school for children who've been suspended for 10 to 45 days. So they are the big troublemakers in the system. Well, we're doing something incredibly unique with them, and it's working. So why are the schools sort of bound by the same way of doing business that they've done in the past? I struggle to understand that.
And
I do believe that it's getting better in that way, that there are more people willing to take risks and do things differently.
Evan, thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you, sir.
We have a lot of other people calling in. Let's get to them. And what Andres Alonso was alluding to earlier, was it the teacher who called in is also my son-in-law, 410-319. This was not a setup. 410-319-8888.
It's very problematic. You know, you know, Mark, you get to call. I mean, what's going on here?
I'm a man who believes in total transparency. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And there's a parent calling in. You're on the air.
In light of the conversation that took place in the last hour, I would like to know what support is available to kids and teens who are gay in the Baltimore City school system, not just high school kids, but middle school kids. I'm experiencing a situation where my gay daughter who is out is harassed and bullied and has been for most of the year because of her sexuality. Mm-hmm. And I have not gotten any support from the administration. In fact, the administration seems fairly insensitive to the issue. And I'm wondering, you know, where do I turn for any sort of relief? And what is being done to help educate teachers and administrators about the issue of, you know, gay kids and gay teens and what they need and how they should be treated?
Well, you know, they should be treated like every other kid, in that they should be protected, supported, taught. The kids come as is. If you have experiences with a particular school where you feel that your child is being bullied, unjustly treated, and you're not getting the support of the administration, then, you know, you need to send me an immediate email and let me forward that email to people like Jonathan Bryce, who's in charge of student support, the guidance counselors in our school system and in the school, and make sure that we deal with it right away. I mean, there is absolutely no excuse for any child in the school system feel that they're being targeted, whether because they're gay or because, you know, they have a disability, or even though it's not the same thing, or because they speak another language, or for any other reason, because they're different, and it's allowed to happen. So it has no place, and it's very much a part of district policy and practice to make sure that everybody understands that there should be no kind of discrimination, prejudice. The kids come as is. Is there a guidance counselor in your child's school?
Yes, there is, who also sort of seems to be part of the problem.
Okay, well, let's not have a personnel conversation. But
okay.
You should email me tomorrow, and my email address is Alonso, A-A-L-O-N-S-O. @bcps.k12. I mean, Mark's staff can give you the full information.
We can do that.
Okay.
And I will intervene in the particular school, because I think it's just unfair to kids to come to school and have to deal with many, many things. We all know that.
Though, would just like to say that I would like to see teachers and administrators get some sort of training or awareness that, you know, this is an issue, it's not going away, and kids are gay, and they find out they're gay as young as 8, and it's not something to try to sweep under the rug, and it's not something to make you go, ew, it's, you know, it's just a part of life.
The kids come as is. And I can't make it any clearer. And, you know, it's unfortunate that I have a parent who's saying people need to be trained to show compassion, show support. And I hope that it's an individual occasion in terms of what's happening with your child. And it's not something that generally reaches me, by the way. So, you know, I don't know what to tell you about that.
So please get in touch with Dr. Alonso's office. I mean, there's no excuse for gay and lesbian students being attacked or ridiculed or anything.
Or children from other countries.
Right.
I mean, every once in a while something like that emerges. And part of what we should be teaching in our schools, and I hope that we all do that, is tolerance and just support for each other. I mean, look, our kids have hard lives. They should be supporting each other in terms of whatever issues they're dealing with. We should not be in the business of making life harder for them.
Secretary Duncan, mm-hmm. Secretary of Education, was on Charlie Rose's show not long ago.
And great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Thank you so much for your call. And please get in touch and let us all know how that works out, because there's no excuse for guidance counselors or principals not supporting the students in their schools. That's their job. Was asked by Charlie Rose about why our schools have not become centers of community. And Secretary Duncan's response was mindset. We need a new paradigm for thinking about our schools. There has not been enough openness to innovation. And it seems that there's been in Baltimore, and you can correct me on this, but that there's been not a systematic effort towards going to a larger community school concept with bringing in all the kinds of groups in, and there seems to be some stumbling block here, some obstacle to making a real community schools and those wraparound services in our schools, engaging families and community residents.
I think we are far ahead of most of the districts in the country. I mean, it's interesting because in Baltimore we have an extraordinary tendency to lash and self-lacerate.
Is that what I'm doing? Don't you think I'm doing?
No, not you, not you. But isn't this true? The you know, it's there's an awful lot of we're not doing this right. The reality is that if you look at districts throughout the nation, some of the things that have been going on in the city before I came in around community schools, you don't see them in many other districts. I mean, we have over 30 community schools already in the district with community coordinators who work with external organizations around this work. This year, we partner with 14 community-based organizations in order to bring parent engagement in over 60 schools. And the parent engagement policy that we just passed and the first caller called about, which is basically telling the community, come on in. You become part of the budget conversation. You become part of the conversations about what programs are in the school. You have a seat at the table in terms of the basic decisions over the school. That's farther than anyone else in the nation is going in terms of making them systemic. The piece that I think that you are referring to is that what we haven't done as well as we should be is bringing in all aspects of community life. You know, other social agencies, businesses, in a targeted way in terms of individual schools. But my sense is that, you know, if you go to Cleveland, go to Detroit, go to New York, go to Philadelphia, go to Washington, go to Atlanta, we are far ahead in that conversation about what needs to happen in the schools. We're just not where we need to be. And the work is about moving it there with all the stumbling blocks and places where people are still saying, no, let me do my job. My job is teaching the kids. You take care of everything else. The reality is that if we're not taking care of everything else, the kids are not going to learn either.
Let me return to the phones, and I'll come back to a question about, we were talking about during break, about your ability to get from school to school. 410-319-8888. Is it CD or CIDI? You're on the air.
I have a question.
Okay.
What will it take for the teaching institutions to make this a serious enterprise rather than simply wasting taxpayers' money? I've listened to the talk and comparisons are being made from one state to another, from one big city to another. But if we look at where we are compared to the rest of the world, given how much money we're spending per student, it's a tragedy. Teaching doesn't have to be fun. It needs to happen in a serious way. And this is not what I see. Students go to school to take drugs, to fight. And then they go to community colleges and they in remedial classes. Something needs to change.
Andres Alonso?
Well, first of all, you know, there's a surreal quality to the question because you've taken every single stereotype about American education and you've portrayed it as the reality. The fact is the following. When we control for socioeconomics, the way American students do is the same as students from all over the world and the country. The biggest correlation, and it's going back 40 years, in terms of how our students do in our schools have to do with socioeconomics. Predictably, children from middle-class families do better than children from poor families, which puts the context of what we do in schools very much at the core of the conversation. Can we work with children who are poor? Can we work with children who have challenges? My feeling is that we must, certain schools do it well. Districts have never done it well to scale. The fact that we are progressing so fast in Baltimore City suggests that we're getting to some of those answers. But to simply say that we're throwing away the the citizenship's money, it's problematic for me because it's not a conversation which is simply about the schools. It's about healthcare. It's about community. It's about incarceration rates. It's about many, many things. That's number one. Secondly, we are at a unique opportunity right now in terms of the conversation about our competitiveness with other countries, in that we now have a change of administration which has put that question of competitiveness clearly on the table, as in how do we measure in relationship to places like Finland, places like Singapore, places like Germany. And I think that we're going to be moving very, very fast towards national standards, which are going to allow us to see how everybody's doing. We're going to be moving very, very fast towards different ways of looking at teacher quality. And we're also going to be moving very fast to questions of the community's interaction with our schools in the way that Mark just mentioned a few seconds ago. I think that as we do those things, also accountability is very clearly on the table in ways that have never been on the table before. But you heard me say earlier in the show that 13 years ago, the graduation rate for Baltimore City was roughly 41-42%. It's now 63%, and we know that it's probably less than that because we don't have the right measurements in terms of how kids graduate. But don't dismiss the hard work that has gone into raising that graduation rate by over 20 percentage points in 13 years. My hope now is that it grows exponentially. So when I not glowingly but proudly say that 90% of my seniors are going to graduate meeting a standard that they didn't have to meet before, that's about people working very hard to make things happen. It's not about people basically coming in to make education a joke.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Let me ask you a question on this. We're going to go back to the phones. I want to read another email that's coming in. If we have time to do all that, I think we try to squeeze it in. We were talking with a break. You were saying something about the inability or ability to get to schools. What were you saying?
It's just been, I was commenting before that it's just been so much harder this year to be in schools every single day than it was.
Why?
In my first year on the job. I think the politics have been different this year, as in, the budget piece. The issue at LaMel every in the year just took me.
Remember the stabbing, the killing at LaMel?
Yeah, took me completely off stride in terms of the ability to get into schools. And then the fact that it became so much harder this year to do a budget, because we had cut so much last year that now it took so much ingenuity to protect the schools in this exercise.
Because you were very clear about trying to get to a school a day.
Yeah, it's been very hard this year, in part because the work has been so much about planning in the central office, about the politics of the work, or for a while about managing the balance of the district at a point where, even though we were making so much progress, one incident communicated that we were falling off the surfboard in a way. And it's been interesting for me that in the first year it was so much easier to do it. In the second year it's been harder. So I've had to depend far more on the meetings with teachers, the meetings with principals, the constant flow of emails to let me know what's going on in the system. I mean, I have the system of communications now where I'm getting, 20, 30, 40 emails a day of the 400 basically saying, you need to pay attention to this. You need to pay attention to this, which is the best communication system in the world, I think, for a school head. Nothing goes unperceived.
So in a minute we have left, I wanted to get to a question on teacher quality, but we'll have to wait that for another day because it's going to be a very long question and a very long answer. And they're telling me we don't have time for that, that it's time for me to start wrapping things up. We have one more minute here. So, what is Andres Alonso's satisfaction level? When do you say that you are satisfied with the direction of where our schools are headed?
I feel a tremendous sense of optimism. Again, I think our scores are going to be up. Our graduation rate is going to be up. Our dropout rate is going to go down. Our enrollment is going to grow again. Where even though we're losing money, we are able to be doing many, many things because we're doing things in a different way. So I feel a tremendous sense of optimism in the work. I just think that the work is hard and we have so much left to go. As I said in the paper today, when I can say that every single child graduates, then my satisfaction level will be where it should be. In the meantime, too much work to do.
Andres Alonso, CEO of Arcidia Schools, has been our guest this hour. Andres, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you,
Pleasure
sir.
To see you. Remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. And this April, Urbanite chose its colors with a green issue, offering a comprehensive guide to eco-friendly living, taking a close look at a green-collar community. Available in print at 800 locations and at urbaniteBaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman, with help from Ashley Boddy. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, and Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews with Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear new interviews, go to the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Happy Passover and take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.